Claire, and you're listening to the Mother Love Podcast, a show where we talk about the journey of parenting. This is a space where guests open their hearts, gather their courage, and tell the truth about what it means to care for these messy and delightful little ones in today's big, wide, and often overwhelming world. We talk about the pressures, the steep learning curves, and the bittersweet reality of watching our children grow. Parenting asks us to be willing to feel it all, celebration and grief, joy and anguish, fear and courage. So take a breath, let these stories wash over you, and show yourself a little love.
Hi, Mother Love listeners. Today, I'm really excited to welcome to the show psychiatric mental health advanced practice clinical nurse specialist, Dana Hillier. And Dana and I always kind of giggle when I announce her title because it's so elaborate and it's such a mouthful. And Dana is such a humble person. So it's always kind of a funny paradox to announce all of that. But Dana is a private practice practitioner based here in Helena, Montana. And she helps patients become aware of and address their individual mental health care needs. Not only is she an incredibly wise and skilled provider, but she's also one of the kindest and most compassionate people I've ever met. And throughout our conversation today, you'll get to hear about how Dana has played a critical role in helping me go from mental health crisis to quite wellness, is I think how I'm going to put it. She's walked through the fire with me, and she has demonstrated just unshakable faith in my ability to recover in times when I felt really scared and hopeless, and I'm already crying.
So am I.
So welcome, Dana. I'm just so honored to be able to have you on the show.
Well, thank you so much, Claire, and I'm so honored to be here. I'm almost getting emotional because it means a lot to me.
Yeah.
It really does.
Yeah, it's kind of going to be a full circle conversation for us today, it feels like.
I think so, for sure.
Yeah, and I'll say full circle because that means that like we could keep going around the circle because healing's not linear. And like even though we're here, you know, we both know things can get hard again. So
definitely. And yeah, that's what life is about.
That's what life is about.
For sure.
Yeah. So diving right in.
Okay.
Why don't you just kind of tell our listeners who don't have the privilege of knowing who you are a little bit about just your life in Helena.
Okay.
Why maybe you're here doing your practice here, and just a little bit more about your career and how you got to where you are today.
Okay, well, we moved here. My husband and I moved here in 1990. Well, we moved to Montana in 1992, and then we moved to Helena in 1995. We were in Oregon, where I was at a different level of psychiatric nursing. I hadn't become an advanced practice nurse at that point in time. We moved here because Bob, my husband, says he wanted to live somewhere where we could get solidly out of town in 15 minutes. That's the 15-minute rule.
That's Helena.
Right.
Yeah.
So we ended up here. We were first in at Montana State Hospital on the Galen campus. We were there first. And then we moved up to Helena, and that's where we've been. And I started my journey with going to Montana State University to get my advanced practice role as a psychiatric nurse, clinical nurse specialist. Mm-hmm. And so that was I started in 92, and then I graduated in 95. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been in this business a long time, 37 years, mm-hmm, doing nursing, and then probably psychiatric nursing for at least 32 of those years, mm-hmm, in various roles.
Yeah. Yeah. And one thing that, you know, is really relevant to listeners is that you do have experience working specifically with women in the perinatal period. And I think a lot of mothers in general, right?
Yes. Oh, yes. You know, and I mean, when I first started in this role, I still see a wide variety of patients. But when I first started, I had women who were not yet pregnant. But then as we worked together, they became pregnant.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
And then I had to figure out what to do. And I can tell you in the beginning, I didn't know what to do. Mm-hmm. And I was following what I think was the standard idea of, well, you took women off their medications.
Yeah.
You didn't, you know, none of the psych medications were safe. So you immediately stopped them. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't good either, you know, and I think
thought that was what you were supposed to do in 2014.
No, yeah. Well, yeah.
2011.
2011. Yeah. Yeah. And this is what I was thinking back, you know, in probably 1997, 98, 99, even in the early 2000s, because we had no real guidelines to guide us as to what we needed to do. And there was this idea that any medication was a danger to the baby and you couldn't do that, mm-hmm. you know? So we would take women off their medication and it was not good. And many of them struggled. And then you didn't know exactly when to get them back on after delivery. And I think we missed a lot of women with really severe illness. Mm-hmm. And women don't always come forth and tell you really what's happening for them. I think that's really key too, because they don't know how to ask and they're scared.
Yeah. Well, and it's so complex once you have a baby, because even if you're not doing well, you're in this place where the message is, it doesn't really matter if you're not doing well, you put your baby first. And when women understand that putting their babies first, when they understand that to mean that means that you taking medication might harm them if you're nursing or whatever, then you're not going to even ask, because it seems wrong to even ask, right?
Right. Because it's all about the baby.
Right.
And so you say, okay, well, I'll just suffer through this. Yep. I'll just work my way through this.
Right.
Just double down.
Yep.
And yet it's not that easy.
Yeah.
And I think in my practice, as I've moved through this, I've learned that more and more as I've worked with women and really understanding that time in life and what it means, because I think women become invisible. It's all about the baby.
Yeah.
And the woman is just second to that. Mm-hmm. You know, she's just the mom, and the mom is expected to do everything.
Right. Yeah.
And, you know, she shouldn't need a break. She shouldn't need help.
Mm-hmm.
She shouldn't be sad.
Yep.
She should be ecstatic. She should be happy.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think what we're finally acknowledging, you know, is that there, the scales between, okay, the risk of medication possibly being harmful, which there's much more research about now, versus the risk of mom being really suffering and the emotional toll that takes on baby, because we now have studied how important it is for moms to be able to engage and bond and mirror, you know, these reciprocal emotions back and forth with their baby. And when you are in the throes of a mental illness, when you're a new mom, and then everything on top of that, like it's just so hard to be able to enjoy snuggle time and enjoy these things that are so, so vital.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And it was made clear to me yesterday with a patient who was in my office, and, you know, she's now 10 months postpartum and she's doing better. And yet she still didn't feel like people were supportive of her at Thanksgiving, when she really wanted a break and she wanted to take just some time for herself. And she really wanted the people around her to say, hey, can I take the baby from you? You know, let me take him and we'll play with him and you go do what you need to do, because she always feels like she's on call for being a mom.
Yes.
Always.
Yeah.
And no matter how she feels.
Yeah.
She's on call.
Totally.
And I think that societal expectation, cultural expectation, has really, you know, impacted women so poor, you know, so much, so negatively, and throughout history,
mm-hmm.
throughout the world, you know, not just here.
Yeah. And there's so much to that. But even just, I think one of the most pervasive things for me in becoming a mom was like the mainstream media portrayal of what early motherhood is like. And then if you add the holidays on top of that, it like ratchets up like 100 to 100. And so then what happened for me was I kept in my mind, it's like I kept this running almost like a film of what I thought motherhood should look like, you know, apron on, mixing and whisking, baby on my hip, happy as can be, laughing, family everywhere. Like, I just thought that that was not only possible, but like what was supposed to happen. And so then when it looks like I've had no sleep, bags under my eyes, I do not want extra people in my home, but here they come, you know, all these like what it even means to just be a hostess in general. And then you have to go back and forth between the needs of your guests and the needs of your baby, and forget about your needs at that point. Like, they're just out the window. So I think that's one of the things that I hear time and time again as I talk to new moms is like, you have to unlearn that conditioning that happens.
Exactly. And how do you unlearn it when mm-hmm. you don't have there's no accepted sort of school about how to do that? Because we still have, you know, it's that idea that, no, that's not what is okay.
Right.
You know, and I think, and you have families. I mean, and I know because I'm guilty of this as a stepmother to my stepdaughter, is that, you know, when she became pregnant with our grandson, I think what happened for me was I got so caught up in that joy of motherhood and being a grandmother and this whole family thing that I completely ignored her.
Yeah.
I completely ignored her. And it was like, no, you know, I thought, wow, it wasn't until much later and more trainings and education mm-hmm. and working with women that I realized, boy, that was selfish. It was hugely selfish.
I don't know. Selfish is accurate, because it's like, I think that happened. I know that happened with my family too, mm-hmm. like up until a certain point. And I think it was like, everyone thought if we celebrate the arrival of this sweet, wonderful new baby, that is celebrating the mom. Like, and people forget that there's a distinction there. Like, I'll never forget, I was sitting in my living room, one of my friends was visiting, and she looked at me and she said, "Are you just the happiest you've ever been?" And like, I knew in that moment that I should have said yes, but I was like, no, I'm actually so tired and scared. Like, that was, you know, but it was those thing of like, oh, this is what people perceive of this time, and this is like something I should be like rising to the occasion, and I just don't have it. It's like I'm trying to dig deep and there's nothing there.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I think for some families, or you know, sometimes I don't know if we ignore it, but we miss it.
Yeah.
And we don't realize that you're tired.
Right.
Because we're also maybe thinking, well, you signed up for that,
exactly.
Didn't you?
Right.
You know?
Yes.
Babies interrupt your sleep.
Yep.
Remember, that's what you learn in, you know, pregnancy 101.
Right.
You know, and
they do.
They do. Of
course. So you need more help.
So you do, you know, and I think, I had that sort of mythical...
Yes.
Approach to even my stepdaughter at the time of the birth of our grandson, and I misinterpreted many cues, mm-hmm. you know, that she was struggling,
right?
Because I was more, you know, maybe not selfish, but more, you know, focused on this wonderful thing, and feeling like, why wasn't she recognizing that, and why wasn't she responding to me?
Yes, yeah,
and my enthusiasm and my, you know. And so we had some unusual interactions, and I thought, oh my gosh, you know, what's going on? And it strained our relationship for a little while.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until much later when I had done some postpartum support international trainings, and I was really working with moms, that I realized, wait a minute, you know, this is what she was having symptoms of, you know, anxiety and depression, and I missed it. And not that I was supposed to know it so much because I'm a provider, but because I really feel like I wanted to be able to say, and I said to her later, much later, is that I wish I could have said, I know you're struggling. I know this is hard,
right.
You know, and I want to help you, and there's help available. What do you need? What can I do?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And that's all it is, right? It's not that hard, but it's like no one wants to sometimes acknowledge that that's happening.
Right.
Because it is supposed to be this joyous time. And then again, it's like, I think we're just shown a very different image of what that time looks like for grandparents too.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's supposed to be all gifts and all the things, you know, and having this new grandbaby and what that says about you, you know, like everyone in your world is going to be celebrating that you now have a grandchild too. And so it is easy to miss. And there is a different level of awareness now where people have the words and the language to say those things that you just mentioned and to recognize like, oh, mom's not just tired.
Right.
You know, that's a different thing.
Right. And if mom is just tired, can we give her
yes.
a break
so
can
that it we doesn't go beyond just tired,
right?
Yeah.
Can we recognize that, you know, especially with holidays, maybe we don't need to go all out, maybe we need to give people the space, you know, to just relax and not feel like they have to meet everybody else's expectations and obligations and, you know, and they can just enjoy being quiet.
Yes. Yeah. Or invite them over so they're not hosting
or
stuff like that.
Right.
Or like just say, hey, we know if you only can stay a couple hours, like that's fine. We'd just love to see you. Just lowering the expectations around holidays in general. We think that we might do like an HMHB team episode leading up to Christmas now that we're in December, and just talk about like what does it look like for moms, you know, the kind of like all the hidden, invisible, behind the scenes labor that goes on to create a magical Christmas. And like, what is that like? What is the list? And dads too. I mean, holidays for the parents, just, I remember the stark, drastic change of like, oh, Christmas used to be fun and relaxing. And now it's like the complete opposite. And you're working almost 24 hours a day and it's expensive. And just the stress around all of that. It's like being able to celebrate with your kiddos and have to hold all of that kind of inside and behind the scenes. So we might do that just because
It's funny and hard. And I think if we begin to talk about it and allow people to say, oh, exactly, that's how it is. And I'm so glad that somebody else is saying that.
Right.
I'm not the only one who thinks this is insane. What am I doing to myself?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. The other holiday that was like this past year that I really noticed, and I think for a couple of years it's been like this, but there have been these polls out on social media of like, what is actually your ideal Mother's Day? And a lot of the moms are saying like, I just want a day off. Like, I just want a hotel room where no one talks to me and I can sleep and eat whenever I want and have my own thoughts. And like, I don't want to have to like get up and go to like my mother-in-law's house, for example. And like, there goes my day, you know, like it's just been this whole thing of like, how do we really need to think about Mother's Day? Like, is it a day that we want mom to spend with her kids the whole day doing all these things? Or do we want to give mom a complete day off and then do that the next day or something? You know, it's just an interesting people, I think, are starting to realize that kind of thing.
That the good housekeeping view of, you know, what Mother's Day should look like or what Christmas should look like
right
is not reality.
No, there's a whole staff baking and cooking and putting those dishes right. in front of the photo shoot, you know, and doing makeup and hair and all the things. And right. that's certainly not what my Mother's Day looks like.
No.
Yeah.
No.
So I know. So there's that. And that, I think that has to do with just the stigma piece overall of having struggles as a mom and specifically mental health struggles. How have you seen like mental health stigma? Do you feel like it's decreasing, not just for moms, or I guess especially COVID was such a notable time for people's health in general, but you know, it was like in hindsight, everyone realized like, oh man, mental health and emotional suffering were at an all-time high and there was nothing to be done about it. So it sort of accumulated. So I guess I'm just curious about your thoughts on that.
I would like to say that it's better, mm-hmm. and yet I'm not sure it really is. Yeah. I mean, I think there are some small pockets where you can say, yes, it's better. But I think during COVID, we looked at it and we go, oh, everyone's mental health is suffering. We need to really rally around people and really support them. And, you know, we have whatever it is online, betterhelp.com. Mm-hmm. You know, you can now mm-hmm. access therapy, you know, over the internet. And yet at the same time, I still don't know if we're really at the point where we really understand that the brain is not separate from yes. the rest of the body. There's no mind-body split, but we still do that.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, I still talk to practitioners when I'm trying to talk to them about the holistic care of a person and saying, well, you know, can you consider this, even though this isn't psychiatry? And they're telling me, no, it's all just psych.
Yeah.
It's all just psych. And you just need to figure out this person's meds. You know, it's not about anything else. And that's just not true.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And I've experienced that is one of your core beliefs as one of your patients, because every time we meet, no matter how much time has gone by, Dana asks me, how are you sleeping? How are you eating? How's your focus? These very basic fundamental things that I think that when we talk about the separation of mind and body, like it's always a reminder to me of like, oh yeah, I guess I haven't been sleeping well. Maybe that's a factor in that I'm not feeling okay. But we forget, like we forget. We just get used to these patterns in our own lives, you know? And so that's been an experience that I've had personally about some of the really unique ways that you operate as a provider. And I've had other, you know, psychiatrists in the past who have been totally on the other end of things, where it's just like this very dry report of just like, and then it's sort of this condescending approach of like, okay, well, I guess that means this then, and we're going to put you on this then. Bye.
Yeah.
Good luck out there. And it's just been really different in us working together. So how did you come to that place where you were able to like understand that those, that holistic care is important, and go from what you were sort of taught originally to how you work with people now?
I think that's been part of my journey in psychiatric nursing. When I did my first rotation as a nursing student mm-hmm. many years ago, I was never comfortable in the ICU. I was never comfortable in cardiac. I was, you know, I mean, I did it, but it wasn't like, this is like, I don't want to do this. This isn't, I don't like this.
Right.
And then I ended up in my first psychiatric rotation. I was in El Paso, Texas at a county psychiatric hospital. And it felt like I had a different way of relating to people. I mean, yes, I was concerned about their overall general health and what was going on, but there was something else about trying to just be with a person.
Yeah.
And I had some good good instructors, good mentors who believe that as well, you know, and that we were focused on the whole person and knowing the person's story. And I think that's, you know, what is really important is that anytime somebody comes to you for whatever reason, for whatever help as a provider, they have a story behind whatever is going on. And yeah. you have to hear that story if you're really going to get to the bottom of what's going on, mm-hmm. you know. And it's not just symptoms. It's like everything else.
Yeah.
It's everything else.
I mean, because usually... And I know there are exceptions to this in terms of genetic inheritance and things like that. But usually the circumstances of one's life are exasperating symptoms if it is something that is present already, or the symptoms have come from just intense stress or trauma, or, you know, it doesn't just happen out of nowhere.
Right.
Yeah.
There's, yes, and that's one thing I think I can say that I learned in from many of my nursing instructors, that all, if you want to say behavior, but all has a reason. There's a right. reason behind it. Mm-hmm. It's not just out of the blue.
Yeah.
Even though sometimes patients feel like it's out of the blue.
Yes.
You know, or people feel it's out of the blue, and it does seem like that. But when you can really delve into it, when you can really develop a trusting relationship with someone, you will suddenly come upon, and it may be years later,
yeah.
you know, oh, okay.
Right.
I think I now understand. I think we now can say this is what's been happening
yeah.
for you.
Yes.
You know, and it isn't, it is, yes, the biology plays a role, but it's not the entire role.
Yeah. Yeah. yeah.
So,
and one thing that I think is really interesting with you, Dana, is like, you remind me that you're not a counselor. However, you know, I mean, your way of relating and empathizing with people, it is very much such a loving and warm and accepting place. And stories do come out in your sessions, and it isn't just about symptoms. And so how do you walk that line? Is it hard?
It's very hard.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can take a lot of this, and I have to decompress.
Yes.
I have to talk to somebody else,
yeah.
you know, because it is, I'm not just this cold, objective person.
Right.
And I have, you know, cried in sessions with patients.
Yeah.
And
I know. I feel like I make everybody cry. Just because I'm such a crier, you know.
Yeah. yeah. And I think because, you know, I'm a human being, and
yeah.
I can't, and maybe I'm not struggling right now in my life, but
right.
that doesn't mean I won't have my struggles, or right. I haven't had struggles.
Right.
And I can't ever put myself, because I'm in this role as a practitioner who can prescribe meds, as somehow above you.
Yeah.
We're human beings,
right.
and we're on the same level.
Yep.
I'm not, you know, I experience emotions and stressors, and I'll have grief in my life just
yeah.
like everybody else.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I truly think that's the magic of the work that you do and the way that you do it. And you and I have talked about, and actually many of the people who I work with, you know, providers and partner organizations, we talk about like, what's the missing ingredient in maternal healthcare right now? And it's that. It's creating trust and safety and empathy, and like, yes, remaining having professional boundaries, but also really helping people to feel safe in telling the truth about what they're going through so that you can care for them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that's one thing about screening that mm-hmm. gets me upset, is that yes, we do need to screen. I don't want to say we don't. It's just that screening becomes this checklist that everybody does. Okay, I screened her,
yep.
you know, and that's it. But you never sat down and asked her.
Yeah.
You know, if you answered yes to this question, can you tell me more about what's going on for you?
Right.
Can you tell me what's happening? you know, if somebody just says, yes, I'm depressed, well, what does that mean?
Yeah.
What is that about?
Right.
And I think that our whole healthcare system, unfortunately, is in this place where we are so caught up on checklists.
Yeah. Agreed. And it's because of the pace, in my opinion, it's the pace at which everyone is operating that makes it, I mean, that's always the excuse. We don't have time. Like, we don't have enough time in an appointment to sit down and hear somebody's life story. And it's like, okay, fine, I get that. But there needs to be, I feel like, an emphasis in training, provider training, no matter what end of the spectrum, but especially in these, you know, common, like, sort of like places where you can maybe catch something before it gets really bad, pediatricians' offices, OBGYNs, all these places where they are key opportunities. In my opinion, my humble, clear opinion, I'm not a doctor, but in my experience as a patient, I feel like there just isn't enough of an emphasis on if you are going to screen. This is a different thing that's taking place than just like your routine, everything else. So slow down. Take the time to look at the mom as she's handing it to you. Does, you know, is it okay to say, like, are you sure you're okay? know, like, I don't know. But I feel like that I had both experiences of being completely dismissed as baby blues at my 6-week appointment where I was clearly not okay, you know, and the damage that did is significant. And then I had another practitioner who did slow down and did like a Dana approach where there was empathy, there was kindness, there was even a piece of like, my daughter went through this when she first had a baby and she was able to get help. And it is okay to take medication while you're nursing. And like these things that all those were factors in me being like, okay, I'll try it.
Right.
But had that not happened on that like human heart level, I don't know. I may not have been willing to accept care or treatment.
Probably not. Yeah. And I know I have walked out of my own provider's offices when I felt like I wasn't treated as if I was a human being and I was had needs and I needed compassion.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I was just treated as, I don't know, a body with some symptoms or something.
Right.
And I should just do what is they're telling me, or nothing's wrong with you. It's all in your head.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Or you should just expect this because this is what's expected.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Yeah, so that can be something that's addressed.
Well,
And I
think about it. I'm precepting some medical students from the Idaho College.
Hallelujah. And how many can you take? Can we send like 500 a year to you?
Right.
Yeah.
And it's been very interesting. And I think they see a whole different world when they come here. And they also are working with Dr. Caldwell, too. And it's just that we have the luxury. And maybe that's because we take the luxury of time. And I keep reinforcing them that you're not. Yes, you have some expertise.
Yeah.
You have knowledge that the person in front of you doesn't have. You're still this person who's a human being who has the same feelings and emotions and life experiences, and you have to be real with them, with everyone, because if you're not real with them, they're going to walk out of your office and never come back.
Yeah. And then all the expertise that you've taken years and spent a whole bunch of money to learn and gain doesn't matter.
Right.
Because if someone is not feeling safe and receptive to it, then you can talk all day about everything that you know and it won't matter.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Because they're not going to hear it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, gosh, I guess I have like the follow-up question to that. Maybe we can tie in how we first met each other because we both were working on the Maternal Mental Health Task Force, which was really amazing, but no longer exists.
I know.
And so I want to talk about like, in terms of knowing that that change needs to be made and knowing that there needs to be a little more extra emphasis on the human connection and that piece of care, do you see that that is getting better in terms of schooling and training? Like, has there been any shift that you know about?
Well, I think there has been in the last, 20 years. We have the Center for Women's Mental Health out of Boston, Massachusetts General Hospital, and you have a lot of practitioners who really focus on maternal mental health. And Lee Cohen, who's a psychiatrist, has been in the work for a long time. So I think we're seeing that emphasis shifting to medical schools and nursing schools. So I'm hopeful. I don't want to think that it's, we're not going to see.
Right.
I think change, though, happens very slowly.
Yeah.
And I think we still have to go back to the basics. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how to say that better than to say that, when you are with anybody who has anything, you have to learn how to be comfortable in your own self.
Right. I think that's a huge piece of it.
Yeah. And you have to be able to, get through your anxiety. You have to work, you have to do some internal work.
Yeah.
As a provider, whether you're an OBGYN or you're a surgeon or you're, family practice or, infectious disease, you have to really be able to do some internal work on yourself in terms of acceptance and dealing with anxiety, dealing with your own stressors, dealing with your own traumas, to then be able to be the practitioner that allows you to sit with a patient and hear what's going on and be genuine and human.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So, and I don't know how to teach that.
Except for to your handful of students.
Yeah. And I hope that when, and I mean, I don't do it 100% perfectly all the time, So, I think what the other thing is, I tell this to students too, is I learn from the people that I'm sitting with. I really learn from you. My practice has evolved because of you, the people that have come to me. It's not because I'm so great. It's really about, wow, this experience changed me.
Yeah.
This gave me an insight I didn't have before. Mm-hmm.
Which is dropping that sort of arrogance that I think gets confused with power and expertise, right, like you said.
Oh, yes, very much so.
There's an unwillingness to remain curious and to learn from patients when you're supposed to be the authority, right, and the person in charge.
Yes, and I think that word is perfect because
it's
the idea to be curious.
Yeah, curious.
Always think, what else could this be? Mm-hmm. Or what else is going on? Mm-hmm. And why am I not figuring this out? Mm-hmm. Why am I struggling with this person?
Yeah.
Because sometimes I do, and it's like, what is it about me that may be interfering with how I'm working with this person?
Yeah.
Because there are always internal biases.
Yep.
Always our own weird stigma that we have, weird anxieties that we have, and they come into play when you least expect it sometimes.
Yeah. And that's so rare to have the ability to self-reflect like that. I think in any circumstance, let alone just being a provider, being a mom, it's being willing to reflect and say, what else could be going on here? Why is this tantrum happening? Let me think about all the pieces. Is it me? Like, those are hard things, but it's again, that sort of like, I'm the authority here. I'm the expertise there. Like, you don't get to question me. I'm not supposed to learn from you. I'm supposed to be the one who teaches you everything, and it's taken me a long time to learn that. But when you are able to soften and really try to put yourself in your kiddo's shoes and say, like, oh yeah, we forgot to have a snack, or oh yeah, like she's not a bad person. She doesn't really hate me. Like, these words are coming from something else, but it does take a lot of humility, and it does take a lot of learning not to be so self-critical, so that you're able to look inside like that and then offer compassion.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I think being a grandmother, and you know, I've never had children of my own, but being with my stepdaughter and learning from her in ways that I didn't know I would learn from her, you mm-hmm. know, is that you really do have to step back as a parent and try to figure this out, because we have this idea that our kids have vertical identity.
Yep.
And they don't.
Oh, I've never heard that term.
Oh, yeah. So that's Andrew Solomon's work mm-hmm. about vertical versus horizontal identity. Mm-hmm. And so many of us want, you know, we have a baby and, you know, we're excited and we have all these dreams and ideas, and this baby's going to be like this, and they're going to grow up to be an artist, or they're going to grow mm-hmm. up to be a doctor, mm-hmm. you know, just like me.
Yeah.
They're just like me, but right. they're not yeah. just like me.
Right.
And my grandson has taught me a lot of humility, believe mm-hmm. me.
Yeah.
Because he's not been easy. And yeah. I have had ideas about him that I'm thinking, that's my stuff.
Yeah.
You know, that's my stuff.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And my mom does that as a grandma too. And it's been something that I've so admired about her, because I know that's not easy. And I know well that she's had to go back and look at mistakes she made as my mother and traumas she went through as a kid and what she learned from her mom. And like, it's been a lot, you know, and she's a counselor herself. So I think she has the awareness of like why that's so important to do. But there's been a lot of repair that's had to take place between the two of us, and really what I've seen is self-repair and self-forgiveness for the things that, you know, she now thinks, oh, I could have done so much better, you know, and just getting out of the cycle of guilt and shame, and how that's made her like just a really different human in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that self-forgiveness piece is also very critical in mm-hmm. in being a parent for mm-hmm. sure, and in being a provider, and in being a human being.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we don't come into this world with any sort of guidebook or, you know, rule book. Okay.
Yeah.
This is how you look it up, and this is how you're supposed to respond.
Right.
And you're going to respond perfectly every time.
Yeah. Right.
You know?
Yeah.
You make mistakes, and mm-hmm. you, when you're self-reflective, you can go, okay, mm-hmm. what was that about? And what do I need to do? How can I take care of myself?
Yeah. 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 What are some of the more common in you working with moms specifically, and like how many new moms would you say you're working with right now?
I'm currently seeing 4 women who have perinatal mood and anxiety disorders who recently delivered, who had, you know, came to me in the postpartum this past year. So they are women that I have diagnosed with a perinatal mood and anxiety disorder and are currently treating. And yet when I think about my entire practice, I have probably about 18 people, mostly women, who I've treated over the years. In fact, I have one woman I've been seeing now for 20 years, and she came to me with a very serious postpartum depression that I treated when she had her second daughter. And so I feel like I have a lot more people in my practice that are still in that realm of perinatal mood and anxiety disorders, even though they may not be currently symptomatic. And I also have 2 dads. I have a father whose wife just delivered her second child in February. And he has had some issues, and she's had issues. And then I also have a new dad whose wife delivered in September. And he reached out to me recently because she was experiencing postpartum depression, and he wanted a counselor. So I was able to connect them with a counselor for her. So I feel like I have this practice that even though there's only four maybe current people that have that diagnosis, I still have all these other people that I've continued to, you know, visit with and be with over the years of their journey through this time. And I think it's still part of what, I think even though they're not symptomatic, they're doing well, I still think it's part of what we talk about sometimes in the sessions.
Yeah, I think that's so important to think about the wide range of people that you see and offer support to, because, you know, when I think especially about the dads who come in, I mean, of course, all the women, and I'm one of your patients that you see, and I'm 11 years into motherhood, but it's been really, really vital for me to seek support, even, you know, I don't know how old Kendall was, but even just for the past few years, like my mothering journey has been particularly intense. And so that's something to consider. But then when I think about when I first started to present with pretty intense postpartum depression, you know, my husband at the time had no idea what to do. And he knew that I needed help, but I saw him struggle just at, like, I think when you are watching a family member and someone who you love dearly and you need them to be okay. You know, I mean, I know that was so hard for him, and he felt like, okay, I need to get Claire help, but he didn't really figure out that he needed help in that time too. And so it's good for me to hear that dads are seeking support as well, because it's just as drastic of a life transition for them, right?
You know, again, getting back to the idea of parenthood, motherhood, I think we have as a society that we like to blame mothers.
Yeah.
We like to really, and blame parents.
Right.
And so I think, you know, you come into parenthood maybe really anxious that you're going to be the bad parent.
Yeah, totally.
And we don't have enough cues in society to help us know that we really are being a good parent. We're doing the best we can.
Right.
Now, I mean, that,
right. Yes.
You know,
yep.
And that if we're struggling, there is help.
Yeah.
There's help for this.
Right.
We're not here. We don't have to do it alone.
Right.
And that's where I think we really need to change as a country, is that we don't have to just do it alone. Mm-hmm. We have a community. We should have a community.
Right. Yeah.
Wraps its arms around people and says, how can I help? Or here's some help that's available.
Right.
Will this work for you?
Right.
And if it doesn't, what might work for you?
Right. Yeah, because I think that, you know, it's interesting, because I think that black and white thinking of good parent, bad parent is another thing that I really struggled with when I became a mom, and still do today for sure. But like this idea of like, okay, so I set out to be a wonderful mother, and I wanted to believe that I would be. What I didn't know was there's no such thing as a 100% wonderful mother every moment of every day, quote unquote, wonderful mother.
Right.
And that if I did make a mistake, it was so, like, it was such a blow to me. And it was so hard for me to grapple with, like, oh my gosh, like, who am I then? I thought I was going to be a good mom. Now I'm a terrible mom. And it was like one little thing that I did that wasn't in line with who I envisioned I would be as this all loving, you know, wonderful, just supportive mom in every situation, including people like flopping around and screaming in Target, like those kinds of moments, right? Where it all kind of comes crashing down. And then it's like I would fall into this deep, like, oh, well, if I'm not a wonderful mom all the time, then I'm a monster. Like, and right. There's be so much guilt and shame that would then pour in, mm-hmm. that then meant, like, okay, well, how do I even come back from this? And it doesn't occur, I think, to most parents and moms to in that moment say, oh gosh, I'm struggling and I should ask for help outside of myself, it's like, oh no, I'm awful. I'm ashamed. I somehow have to figure out how to get back to wonderful mom land. But now I know I'm actually a terrible mom. And it's this whole thing that takes over.
I think so. And yeah. So how do you, I mean, I'm thinking about you. How did you work through that? How mm-hmm. did you, what helped you?
You. I mean, honestly, it helped me to hear stories of other moms who could relate. And it helped me to know, like, it was like baby steps. Like, once I was able to accept a little bit of help, then I could see that benefited, like, not only me, but it benefited my kids. And so once I learned that, like, me admitting that it wasn't all up to me to figure all this out, when I could see that that was then helping my children, then I became more receptive to more help and bigger help. And I was able to say in moments that were really hard, and when I really knew I wasn't okay, I was able to, like, tell someone, like, hey, I don't think I'm okay. Like, and I don't know what to do, but I'm afraid of what will happen if I keep doing this and keep going down this path. And, you know, then it's like, as soon as you say that out loud, which is so scary to do, because it's admitting it to someone else and to yourself, then it's like, okay, then, you know, but then it's out, and then there's something to be done about it. It doesn't just continue to cycle through internally. And I think that's where really I had to learn. And then then I sought counseling, and I did go on medication, and I did start to realize that I did start to grieve the person I thought I would be as a mom. I started to let her go because that was never going to happen, I realized. And I started to embrace, like, just and accept, like, I am someone who struggles with mental health. I always have been, you know, there were all kinds of risk factors for me. And so then it's just accepting, like, okay, this is us then. This is what our family looks like. This is what I look like as a mom. And what am I going to do to make sure that we're all okay as we possibly can be?
Right.
But getting there is really hard.
It's extremely hard. And it takes a lot of courage, and it takes a lot of, I hate the word work, but it takes a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And it's not always, you know, you climb up one hill and you think you're on top and things are going to be smooth, and then you can find yourself rolling down that hill mm-hmm. again. And I think that kind of is part of my, maybe this is sort of the Buddhist part of my philosophy, is that it isn't that you fall down the hill. Mm-hmm. It's that you're going to get back up.
Mm-hmm.
That if you can see yourself as that, okay, I've rolled down the hill, but my legs are under me. Maybe I can stand up, and maybe I'll wobble.
Mm-hmm.
I can still keep going.
Yeah.
And that's really what we need to help people with. It's not mm-hmm. that you're going, that anytime you roll down the hill, that it's a disaster and it's all over with.
Right. Yeah. And I think that was a huge lesson for me, was just like learning that, okay, oh, let's stick with the hill example. So you slide back down the hill, you're at the bottom of the hill, but I'm able to recognize more quickly that I'm at the bottom of the hill. I know the territory. I know what it looks like. I know what it looks like if I keep sliding further and further and go underground, you know, like, and I know that if I get up and I'm wobbly and I'm weak, that I don't have to do it by myself. Like, I can call my friends who know how to help me get back up the hill. And I think, like, that for me is huge. And I still hate doing it. I still hate calling my people and saying, like, hey, I don't know what's up, but, like, I'm not okay, you know, but I know that I have to do it because I know what it looks like if I don't. And it's like any hard lesson in life, the more you learn it over and over. And I don't know, I'm so stubborn and strong-willed about things in my life and learning lessons the hard way, that I really think that if I didn't have kids, I don't know that I would have ever been willing to accept help, you know, like, but they have made me need to. And so that's one of the beauties of motherhood, is like, if you are going to put your kids first, it doesn't look like being the perfect mom and doing everything right in every situation. It looks different than I thought. It looks like messing up and getting help forgiving yourself.
Right.
You know, and it looks like looking at them and being like, man, I'm sorry I lost my temper on the way to school. You know, and those are the things that are so different about finding wellness than I had imagined and envisioned.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's much more gritty and messy than I thought.
Yes. It is gritty and messy. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we have to say, but that's okay because life is gritty and messy.
Yep.
And yet there's also quite a lot of joy in that grit and mess.
Mm-hmm.
And you can find it.
Yeah.
You know, because it isn't just, there's just not this wonderful, everything's wonderful all the time,
right.
You know.
Yeah.
Because it won't be wonderful. Mm-hmm. And having that place to know, okay, my life is pretty gritty and messy right now, and I need some help. I need my friends around me, or I need to my mom around me, or
right.
I need this around me. And I know I'll be okay then, because I think it's also knowing that if you have that support,
yeah,
you can really begin to believe, okay, I will be okay. I'm not going to slide down that hole in the ground and never come back up.
Yeah. And that people genuinely want to help. Like, I feel like I've said this 100 million times on this podcast, but one of the hugest breakthroughs for me was realizing, going from feeling like a burden to going to realizing that the people who love me wanted to help me.
Right.
It wasn't a burden to them when I called and said, I'm depressed. They were like, thank you for telling me. How can I help? And I didn't realize that when people love you, like, they don't want you to hide that from them. They want to be there, you know? And I think, I don't know, that's one of those truths that it's just taken me a lot to get to realize that. And I have to remind myself all the time, like, instead of saying sorry, just say thank you. it's over and over that for me. Like, I'm so sorry, I have to ask for help. And then it robs the people who are helping you of their joy in helping. When you say, I'm so sorry, you know, then it takes away their joy. And when you say, just thank you, I couldn't do this without you, that's a different kind of reaction and interaction, and it makes it so much more it makes them feel like they're important.
Right. It makes you feel as if this relationship is really critical to, you know, each other's well-being.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is.
Yeah.
You know, when you can ask for help and say thank you, and the other person says, I'm so glad you let me help
you.
Because I want to help you when you need it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then you can, then, you know, it's that idea that when your friend needs help,
mm-hmm.
you are there.
Yes.
You know, in that reciprocity of mm-hmm. being there. And I think it gets back to kindness and compassion.
Yeah.
I really do.
Me too. Yeah.
And just on the level that it's this in our world, because I think that's the one thing that's missing so much is kindness and compassion.
Yeah.
You know, it's there. It's not that it isn't. It's just that we need to practice it.
Yeah. Yep.
As much as we can. And not that, you know, we have to be saints and go out and be.
Yeah. Right.
Because today you may not feel like you can be compassionate or kind, and then you have to give yourself grace and go, today I can't do that.
Yep. And today I'm the one who I need to be kind and compassionate to. Because usually if you can't do it, it's because there's something going on inside of you that needs your own attention and grace, in my experience.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then that's it. Give yourself grace.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because we also have to do that as well.
Mm-hmm.
We you know, this idea of perfection is silly, because none of us is perfect.
It's true.
And we strive. We strive to do the best we can.
Yeah.
And I think if we keep that in mind and we keep doing the best we can and giving yourself grace and stepping back when we've made mistakes and acknowledging if we've, you know, yelled at our kids and mm-hmm. just say, I'm sorry, that wasn't okay.
Yeah.
And not try to justify it, not try to explain it, just say, it wasn't okay and I'm sorry and I'm going to really work hard, you know, yeah. not to do it again.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And we just have to keep in mind that we can all learn from that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I do want to talk about, before we start running out of time, I want to talk about a couple of things. And so one of your, you know, one of your things that is a part of your job description or the way that you operate, is this idea of supportive psychotherapy in acceptance and commitment therapy.
Okay.
And I think that's a really unique part of my experience in working with you. So just like to give a concrete example of how I've experienced that with you, and then I'd love to know about how you learned and put those things into practice, is like I have a bipolar 2 diagnosis, you know, and I go through cycles of bipolar things where I feel really wonderful about the world and then I feel like everything is doomed forever, which is pretty classic. And it took me a really, really long time to even start to be open to that diagnosis. I still struggle with identifying with that diagnosis, but part of your work is this acceptance, helping people accept what that means in their life. And one thing you did for me that was so crucial, Dana, was that you gave me books to read that were about other creative people who had this same mood disorder and dysregulation disruption. Because my biggest fear was that a lot of times during more of my up times, I was super highly creative and a lot of my writing and productivity and ideas came from that place. But then when I would experience these crashes, you know, I was like, what a joke. How did I ever think I could write that?
Right.
Which is a really hellish way to live, honestly. But I know that that's the experience of a lot of people who have bipolar. There are highly creative people and like famous highly creative people who are really successful in the world. And you gave me K. Jameson Redfield?
Redfield Jameson.
Her book, a couple of her books.
Right.
And I just remember reading them and having that feeling that you sometimes get in your life of complete acceptance, because it was like, oh my gosh, this is me. Oh my gosh, Dana was right. Oh my gosh, like this isn't actually the end of the world. There's a way to work with it and channel these creative parts of me that aren't going to die if I get therapy and, you know, and accept that medication could actually be helpful. And so that part of the acceptance and the being able to work with people on, I guess this is pretty specific to my diagnosis, but like feeling better and wanting to go off medication, you know, it's like such a common thing. And we've talked about that so many times and you've never once like been like, no, Claire, that's a terrible idea. We always talk about it. What would that look like? What would that be like? Why is it dangerous to maybe consider doing that? You know, it's always been a conversation. So will you talk about how you learned about that acceptance and like being supportive in that way, that piece?
Okay, let me think about this.
The acceptance in particular, because okay. I think when people receive a mood diagnosis, it's really hard.
It's very hard. I think probably anyone who receives, especially a bipolar diagnosis, but even a diagnosis of maybe schizophrenia mm-hmm. or any of the other, even depression, can have so much of a stigma, because we really believe as human beings that we're just supposed to pull ourselves up by the bootstraps. We're going to fix this. We just have to eat better. We just have to sleep better. We just have to run more. We just have to do this more and we're going to be fine. And we don't realize that not always is that going to help us be fine. It's also the fact that we are this biological creature with these, you know, neurotransmitters, mm-hmm. you know, brain processes that go awry. without our having any control over them.
Not to mention all those things that you said that are really healthy for you are completely unavailable to me.
Right.
If I'm in a depression.
Right. Because when you're in a depression, you don't have the energy, the motivation.
I don't want to eat. All I want to do is sleep. I definitely am not running on any trails. You know, I'm not getting outside. I don't want to see anyone. So that's what's interesting to me is like, I kept thinking, well, I need to try all these alternative things before I try medication. And I think that that's common. And if that works for you, awesome. And there are people where like they do just need to make lifestyle changes and then they're good to go. But for me, it was the other way around. For me, it was as soon as I was well, I considered medication to be actually therapeutic, which is one of your words that you used with me. I know you didn't like coin the like therapeutic dose, for example. But once I started to really be open to that, it was like, now I can exercise. Now I can get fresh air. Now I want to go hang out with my friends and like all those things. But I those weren't available to me before I was feeling well.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think in helping you to accept this diagnosis. And also, I think this is not my own thought, but this is what we talk about as shared decision making. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, I don't want to say you either do it my way or the highway or leave.
Right.
You know?
Because I would have left.
You would have left. I mean, if I had been that, you know,
right.
If I had been that autocratic with yeah. you wouldn't have been here. So I think I wanted to say, okay, well, let's talk about what mm-hmm. medications can and cannot do mm-hmm. and what you're experiencing with them. And okay, if you don't want to go up right now, we won't go up and let's see what happens. Mm-hmm. Let's see how you feel. Maybe mm-hmm. you'll feel okay. Mm-hmm. Maybe this will be the right dose. Mm-hmm. Because I think then you buy into it and you go, you feel free to tell me, oh, I don't think this is really working now.
Right,
you know? I think that I now think that maybe I might do better on a higher dose mm-hmm. because I'm just still not where I want to be. Mm-hmm. I'm still having those cycles or I still right. can't get myself to go out and,
right.
you know, go run on the trails or
right.
get out in the sunshine. Mm-hmm. And I really want to, but yeah. I can't.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and and because of the nature of me, like it was really important for me to kind of run that experiment on my own and come yes. to that conclusion on my own. Because had I not, it's not like just about you telling me what to do and that being the thing, but had I not, I would always wonder, do I really need this? Do I really need to be on this high of a dosage? Can I, you know, like... And we can do it the other day. Like, what if I want to go lower? And we have done that. And so then I go lower and I'm like, oh, this doesn't feel good. But I have had to find those things out and I couldn't just hear them from someone else.
And I think that's
very uncooperative that way.
No. I think that that's how you work with people is yeah. you say, okay, let's try it.
Yeah.
Let's see what happens. Mm-hmm. You know, and it is, you need to, you know, how's that working for you? If that's working for you, great.
Mm-hmm.
If it's not, let's talk about it. Mm-hmm. Let's see if there's another thing that can help you or another way this can work.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's really about that. It's you're in your body, you're in your life and your experience. I'm out here. I'm a little guide. I can give you information.
Right.
I can offer suggestions and then we can talk about it and make a decision together.
Mm-hmm. And I really had to learn about you and your character and how you operate, because there is also this message out in the world when it has to do with mental health and stigma and assumptions and all of these things that says that everyone overprescribes. Everyone just wants to give you the magic pill. Pharmaceutical companies are secretly paying all your doctors, right. you know, like, and I don't doubt that that goes on sometimes. I totally sure. think it does.
Right.
But I had to get to know you as a person and as someone who truly cared for me, like as a patient and as a person, like as a human being, like we've been talking about this whole time. But like, I had to really learn to trust that that wasn't what you were doing before. And it took me like... a long time. Probably at least 6 months of us working together. Maybe more.
Probably more.
You're like, I remember it taking longer. But I mean, I just think that that's a huge factor is like if the trust isn't there, then I constantly would have questioned is this necessary or is it just Dana's ulterior motive? You know, is this an agenda being pushed on me or not? And especially coming out of like women who've just had like birth trauma, where they did have every piece of their control and what they were trying to express completely taken away and ignored and dismissed. And the doctors just did do whatever they wanted to do. You know, then you're dealing with that like trust rupture that has happened and having to try to come back from that. And so it's just,
it's huge. That's huge.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I've learned that trust takes time and I have to really, and I have to tell myself that when I, you know, when a patient leaves and I'm like, why aren't they,
right?
Why aren't they hearing me? Why aren't they doing this?
Yes.
But then I have to say, wait a minute, you know,
this is
about trust. Mm-hmm. They don't trust me yet. And we really need to work on that. And I need to work on that, you know, so it is huge trust. And it's also when you talk about, you know, you learning about me, it's also me learning about you. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the other piece to this, mm-hmm. is that in order for me to do what I do, I need to, everyone's unique and everyone's different. And I can't assume everyone's going to follow things the way I want them to follow in the beginning, you know?
Yeah.
And so I have to be gentle with you and I have to be gentle with myself, you know, and just step back and go, whoa, wait a minute.
You know,
this isn't life or death right now.
Right.
We can
right now. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, good. That's a really good segue into my very last question then, which is, especially since the pandemic, it's not a secret that there's been a really high burnout rate for people who work in healthcare and for people who care for others. And I think one thing that's come out of this is this awareness of secondary trauma and how providers have the task of caring for themselves when they're not taking in all of this emotional, all these hard stories and all of these emotional, you know, I don't know how to say it, but just, it's just a lot to absorb in a day, a lot of hard energy coming at you. So how do you, what are some like practical ways that you take care of yourself in that way?
Well, I think the one way that I do that is that, once a year we go backpacking and I'm completely off the grid.
Yep.
And we, you know, at least for a week, I'm nowhere to be found. Mm-hmm. And that helps a lot. And I think the other thing is that even though I've always allowed patients to have access to me when I'm not backpacking, I really, on the weekends, I don't turn on my computer. I don't even turn on anything. I really try to be in the moment. I like to be outside. Mm-hmm. I like to garden. I like to do my yoga. I like to just be in the moment as much as I can. And I also have to do a lot of breathing and I have to do a lot of self-reflection and I should, you know, there's things I should do more of, you know, mm-hmm. And I'm hoping to do more as I get older and have a little more time.
You're not getting older. You're not retiring.
No, I'm not retiring.
Never.
But I think, you know, and I'm lucky. I have a really, you know, I have a husband who, you know, himself is a provider, and I think we can both talk about what we've experienced and share things in a way and know that it's, you know, somebody's listening to me, that this was a hard story I heard today, and here's what I'm thinking and, you know, mm-hmm. and just be able to, or just have a shoulder to cry on,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Yeah. To be able to say, this is a hard story. This is what I heard today. And here's how I'm feeling about it.
Right.
Because you have to compartmentalize how you're feeling about these things.
Right.
Not completely, in a way that keeps you available.
Right. I can be human in a session, but I also have to somebody can't take care of me.
Right.
I'm here to take care of you right now. You can't take care of my feelings.
Right.
So I have to find ways to take care of my feelings.
Yeah.
And I work at that. And yeah. Some days it's easier and some days it's harder.
Yeah. And you do fun stuff, like you're having a cookie party this weekend.
Yes.
Let's talk about that. What kind of cookies are you going to make?
I'm going to make Greek butter cookies.
Ooh, yum.
Yeah. So they're a Christmas cookie that we used to make, my mom and I, years ago.
Oh,
so yeah.
That's cool. Yeah. And you gather with all your friends every year?
No.
This is the first time?
This is the first time. I don't know if people know, but you can go online and there's this site that there's a day for this. And so every day of the year, you can see why people celebrate. So yes. December 4th is actually National Cookie Day, but because it's on a Monday and I have to work, we're doing it on December 2nd.
Yes.
So I have a few of our friends are coming and they're bringing their favorite cookies and we're going to share recipes and stories about making cookies. And
I love that.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so fun. Yeah, because we're off and running into December now. So
I know.
Parties like that are going to be important.
And yet we also have to say, okay, I don't have to go to every party. Mm-mm. And I don't
just
have
the cookie party,
the cookie party. And I don't have to do, I don't have to have all these wonderful things, that, as I said, you just get inundated with these images of what your house is supposed to look mm-hmm. like and what your tree is supposed to look like. And
yeah, it's a lot. I'm yawning as you're saying it because my system is like, no. Yeah. Right. Okay. Well, I always like to end with a couple of rapid fire questions. We've started doing this.
Okay.
And I'm stealing ours from Brené Brown's podcast.
Oh, okay.
Which is called Unlocking Us is the name of it.
Okay.
Where did they go? And so just a few fun questions to kind of end the episode on a fun note. So this one's not that fun, but it kind of is. Number one is fill in the blank. Vulnerability is?
Oh. Vulnerability is genuine.
Mm. Yeah, that's good. What is something that people often get wrong about you, Dana?
I think they think that I have it all together and that
don't
I never get angry. I never get scared. Yeah. I never get anxious. Right. I never get sad.
Yeah that is true. I do think that about you.
yeah
and it's helpful to know that what I think isn't true.
Right.
Yeah What's the last show that you watched and loved? Do you guys watch shows? If not, book.
But
it's the last book you read. Yeah, this is more my jam too.
Okay.
Yes.
So this is probably one of them. Well, there are two books. So can I do two?
Yes. Oh, my gosh. Of course.
Okay.
You can do 10. I'm a book person.
The Many Daughters of A Fong Moy by Jamie Ford.
Okay.
And if you don't know Jamie Ford's work, you need to know his work. He's a Montana author.
Oh.
And The Many Daughters of A Fong Moy is an incredible book about historical trauma. It's not a true story, but it's based on some truths. It's remarkable.
Okay.
So that was one of the best books I've read this year.
Nice.
And he's just an amazing writer.
Yeah.
And
I've never heard of him.
Oh my goodness. You need to hear. He wrote The Hotel on the Corner of Bitter and Sweet.
I have heard of that book. Yes.
So that's a love. They're just wonderful books.
Yeah. Okay.
And then the other book, and I'm not sure if I know her name. I think it's Amanda Corbin. She wrote The Orchardist.
Mm-hmm.
And that again is, that has underpinnings for maternal mental health in a very different way. It's a lot about trauma.
Uh-huh.
And it's so beautifully written. And it's just, those are two books.
So
that
your self-care is that you go home and read about trauma.
Right, exactly.
But I mean, in creative ways, I can see how that'd be helpful to process.
Well, and I think when you are able to, read the words of mm-hmm. somebody who, they're not a provider.
Right.
They're not a medical person. And yet they've obviously done research
right.
and things like that, but they bring the stories to life,
yeah,
and bring my thoughts to life in their words. Sometimes mm-hmm. things I've thought about yeah. and they've said it, and it's just like, okay.
Yeah, that is the best when you're reading and you feel known like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, good. I love that. What about a film you really love?
Oh, that's a hard one because there's so many I love. Ooh, you put me on the spot, and I'm always hard to just grab it out of the... Well, there's one that is a French film, and it's called Emma Bovary.
Oh.
But it's not, it's a modern day tale of a woman whose name is Emma Bovary, and she's comes to the French countryside, and it's a delightful story.
Okay.
It's a great film.
Yeah.
And so it's fun, and it has nothing to do with trauma.
Okay, cool. I'm glad to hear that there are some forms of entertainment that don't have anything to do with trauma for you.
Right.
What's your favorite meal right now?
My favorite meal would be salmon.
Really?
Yes.
How cooked? How?
So cooked over the grill, and we have this wonderful ginger chipotle honey sauce that we put on it, and
yum.
I love it.
Yeah,
it's my absolute favorite.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. What's on your nightstand right now?
Oh, The Architect's Apprentice, and it's by a Turkish, a woman from Turkey who writes, and it's an interesting. I mean, I'm going to finish it. It's not like the best book I've mm-hmm. read this year, but it's a wonderful book about Istanbul in the 1500s and about architecture. And she was mentioned on NPR, so I, you know, decided to read her book. And it's a lovely book in many ways. It's also hard to read because it's got a lot of, you know,
architectural jargon.
It's awful.
No, just kidding.
And it also, you know, there's also all the stuff that happens in history of wars and
right.
that
yes.
kind of stuff.
But, yeah.
But it's a lovely story in some
yeah.
ways.
Okay. It's a good nightstand story.
Yeah.
If you know
yeah.
what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, just a couple more. Give us a snapshot of an ordinary moment in your life that brings you great joy.
There's so many things.
They can be really simple, too.
You know, I think one of the best things is when I can sit down with my partner, my husband, and we can be listening to music,
yeah.
you know, because we both love music and mm-hmm. that brings great joy.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah.
And we can share that moment together of whatever we're hearing.
Yeah. That's awesome. I love that.
Yeah.
Last one. What are you deeply grateful for?
Oh. I am deeply grateful for the people that have come into my life through the work I've done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm very grateful for that. I don't know if I would be the person I am today without that. And that goes back from my first days as a psych nurse mm-hmm. in a psychiatric unit mm-hmm. in a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and also for the mentors I've had too mm-hmm. along the way.
So. Yeah. Well, I wouldn't be the person I am today without you. So I'm deeply grateful for you.
Thank you.
Really, truly. Yeah. I mean, I would encourage anyone listening that, like, if you've had hard times with trying to get help and trying to get care, like, don't give up, you know, because there are genuine people out there who are practicing from their heart, and it's worth continuing to seek until you find them.
Yes, and they're out there. They
yeah.
really are. And you'll know it because you'll be in the room with them and you will feel it.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that. And even if it's not an immediate, you just know that it's a place that you're safe.
Mm-hmm.
And you can feel safe in.
Yeah. But don't everybody call Dana because she's pretty busy. And I'm one of her patients. But yeah. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Dana.
Oh,
thank you.
Thank you, Claire. This was lovely. I really, from the bottom of my heart, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mother Love is hosted by Healthy Mothers, Healthy Babies, the Montana Coalition, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the health and well-being of families who are expecting or raising little ones. Opinions and views expressed in these interviews do not necessarily represent the views of HMHB as an organization. We sincerely value the lived experiences shared on Mother Love, and we understand that not everyone will agree with or relate to all of what is shared. Mother Love exists to help our guests and listeners honor and embrace their own stories and experiences. If the content in this episode has caused you concern or distress, please reach out to someone you trust for support. Speaking up about our struggles is half the battle, sometimes more than half, and there are many providers who can and want to help. Visit our statewide online resource guide at www.hmhb-lifts.org to help you find resources in your area.
Thank you to our incredible editor and producer, Brooke Boone Miller, for sharing her gifts with us. She's a mom, and she gets it, and for that we are so grateful.